Support for Yale Cancer Answers comes from AstraZeneca, working to change how cancer is treated with personalized medicine. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com. Welcome to Yale Cancer Answers with Drs. Anish Chagpar and Stephen Gore. I'm Bruce Barber. Yale Cancer Answers features the latest information on cancer care by welcoming oncologists and specialists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer. This week, it's a conversation about gynecologic oncology and HPV-related cancers with Dr. Elena Ratner. Dr. Ratner is an associate professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at Yale School of Medicine and co-chief in the section of gynecologic oncology. Dr. Gore is a professor of internal medicine in hematology at Yale and director of hematologic malignancies at Smilo Cancer Hospital.
So GYN cancers, I think, it seems to me like a lot of women know they're supposed to be seeing their GYN for reproductive health. Hopefully, everybody knows that. And I wonder how many of the patients, how many healthy women understand exactly what they're being screened for in terms of normal GYN health. Obviously, people get pap smears. We all know that. And then they get all these kind of unusual physical exams and stuff. So what are people being screened for cancer-wise?
That's actually an excellent question because we frequently have women asking exactly that. So yes, it is imperative for women to see their gynecologist because so much right now in gynecologic cancers is about prevention. We don't even talk about treating cancers or even finding them early anymore. The future and the present is about cancer prevention. So when a woman sees her gynecologist, her gynecologist can screen her for cervical cancer, and that's where pap smears come into play. And we'll talk a little bit more later today about checking HPV as part of that workup. Mm-hmm. But additionally, that's not the only thing. Additionally, women also have a good pelvic exam. And that looks for any cysts or any masses in the ovary or any masses in the pelvis or any abnormalities with the uterus. So even though we don't really have screening tests for uterine cancer or ovarian cancer, pelvic exam serves as that.
Well, but how common are those cancers in patients who are otherwise healthy? I mean, you're talking about women of reproductive age or post-reproductive age and is this really something people should be worried about?
Yeah, absolutely. Endometrial cancer is the most common gynecologic cancer. In the United States, there's an epidemic of endometrial cancer,
really?
Partly because of obesity. Obesity increases risk of endometrial cancer.
Huh.
The good thing about endometrial cancer is that there are symptoms and there are signs. And so much of what we do is awareness for women to know that if they ever have bleeding after they have reached menopause, that is not normal.
Mm.
And once they have the bleeding and they go see the gynecologist, usually these cancers are diagnosed very early and they're completely curable. So this is where prevention comes into play. And in this case, prevention is awareness, just knowing that once you reach menopause and you no longer get your periods, if you start bleeding, that is not normal and that you need to see your provider.
But not every bleeding postmenopausally is cancer, right?
So I was just going to take that. Thank you. Took it away from me. So, but yes, please remember, absolutely not all bleeding. Actually, most bleeding postmenopausally will not be cancer. There's so many reasons it could be. There's polyps. There's atrophy. There's all kinds of benign things. But the key
is never normal.
The key is to never normal and always see your provider because they can see why the bleeding is happening.
Hmm. Well, I hear, I'm clearly not a woman and I've never had a pelvic exam. Might surprise you, but it's true. but I know that it's not something women traditionally look forward to, many women. And I know obviously there's ultrasound and CT scans and MRIs and biomarkers and stuff. And so, is there still really a role for a physical exam? Shouldn't we just be scanning everybody yearly or something like that?
Yeah, so that's a wonderful question as well. Because, yes, in this day and age, we're all so tempted to just order a test. But In gynecology, nothing is as important as a physical exam.
Really?
Yeah. There's nothing that is better than your fingers. When you feel for the cysts or nodularity, there's nothing that is better. CAT scans are not better. Ultrasounds are not better. So currently, there's guidelines that are changing in pap smear screening. Mm-hmm. This just happened a couple of months ago, and what the new screening guidelines are is that instead of pap smears, you can just have an HPV test. HPV test is very easy. It is like a pap smear. And the reason we do that is because we know that for cervical cancer, HPV is the definitive test. Great majority of cervical cancers and precancers are HPV related. So if a woman does not have HPV, then her risk of cervical cancer or precancer is significantly lower.
No kidding.
Yeah. And now, because of that, and because of all this literature, and because of cost savings, these kind of testing can be done once every 5 years.
No kidding.
Yeah. Right. But it's so important, and this is why I'm bringing it up at this juncture, is that we do not confuse guidelines for pap smear or guidelines for cervical cancer screening with the need of still seeing your gynecologist once a year.
I see. And is the screening, the screening for the papillomavirus, is that done with a cervical swab? Or is it a blood test, or how do you do that?
At this time, it is a swab that you do kind of just like a pap smear, and there's different ways of getting it done. And once this test is negative, then depending on your age, women don't have to get it repeated for a good 3 to 5 years.
Right. And if it's positive, does that mean they have cancer?
No, not at all. HPV, human papillomavirus, is very, very common. There's certain ages where 80 to 90% of women have it. Mm-hmm. And HPV virus by itself actually does not cause too much trouble. It's only the HPV virus that doesn't clear itself. So we never check HPV virus in young women. We never check it in women younger than 30 because so many of them will have it and so many of them, majority of them, will clear it. So those HPV viruses don't matter. The ones that we watch a little bit closer are the ones that persist after age 30, and those are the women that need that test and the pap smear have been done more frequently than 3 to 5 years.
So they still get regular pap smears, the people who are HPV positive.
Correct.
What about the stigma associated with HPV? I mean, traditionally it's a sexually transmitted virus. We still have a bit of a puritanical culture in many parts of our country. Do you have a problem getting women past that?
So that's another wonderful question. Yes, you know, it is. So it is very much an issue that comes up and the question that comes up. And most importantly, it comes up with vaccination. As you know, we have had this Gardasil vaccine that's now been out probably a good 10 years, if not more. And it has been incredibly, incredibly successful in decreasing rates of HPV and hence decreasing rates of precancer and
cancer.
It's
amazing.
It is incredible. It is what we've always looked for. We've always dreamed of, exactly. We've always dreamed, and as a physician who deals with this all the time, I actually see this on an everyday basis. You know, my cervical cancers that I see are way less, precancers I see are way less. It is. It's a dream. It's what we dream for all cancers.
That's why you're taking so much vacation time, right?
It's what we dream for all cancers. But the truth remains is that a lot of states and some women do not vaccinate their children because of the stigma that this carries. And there is no stigma, and there shouldn't be stigma. This is a very prevalent, very common virus that is very, very contagious. It's very easy to get. A lot of women, a lot of men have it. And there shouldn't be stigma. It really should just be a way for prevention and cure of this cancer so that cervical cancer should not exist in the future.
Why are you letting the fathers off the hook?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Not the fathers, not the boys. You know, I have two older boys who both got this vaccine.
Right.
I think this is something that's, prevalent, and everybody should be vaccinated. You know, HPV doesn't just cause cervical cancer. It causes vaginal cancer. It causes vulvar cancer. For men, it causes anal cancer. And for women, it causes anal cancer. It can cause throat cancer. You know, so this is not something that women should be singled out. And again, this is an opportunity, not just for women, but also for men, not to have to deal with cancers in the future.
Right. I think it's important for people to know about the head and neck cancer in men. Again, when you start talking about anal cancer, we're talking about not only, you know, puritanical feelings about sexuality in general, but then we have this whole issue about how comfortable people are with acknowledging that they don't know whether their boys eventually will be heterosexual or homosexual, right? I mean, this is
absolutely
part of our changing society, although I think it's getting better.
I do. You know, coming just from a conference in Europe, it is so not even a conversation in Europe, and it continues to be a conversation here. And I think that's just, but yes, I agree with you. I think we are now seeing the fruits of the first batch of these vaccinations. We're now seeing much less of these precancers and cancers, and not just as physicians. I think as women, as patients, we see this. So mm-hmm. I think this is the fruits of the labor.
Yeah, it's terrific. And do you think that pediatricians are, how do I want to put this? Are pediatricians doing their job in promoting the vaccinations?
I do. I certainly do. I mean, at least here in Connecticut, it's super, super rare that I see a younger woman now who hasn't had a vaccine.
Oh, so the uptake is pretty good around here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, we were very excited when, you know, our son was just about the right age when they approved it for boys. I think we might have even done it before it was approved for boys because we just knew that it was the right thing to do. And, you know, it's always been my hope as a parent that my children will have a healthy sexual life when they're adults, right? I mean, none of us want our kids to be celibate, I don't think. So, seriously, and you know, the fact of life is that in our society, sexuality is not one partner the rest of your life, often for many people.
Of course. And again, this is, you know, we shouldn't look at it as that. We should look at this as cancer prevention,
right.
Period. You know, this is not about values or future hopes. This is truly, singly cancer prevention.
Right. And back to the whole exam thing, the vaginal or vaginorectal exams, I think it's important for women to know, and maybe everybody knows this, maybe, I don't know, that your risk of cancer doesn't stop when you're in the post-reproductive ages, post-menopause, or if you're not sexually active. Am I correct there?
That's exactly correct. On contrary, most of our cancers do appear later in age, you know, in the women's 60s, late 50s, mid-60s. So yes, you're absolutely correct. On contrary, once women reach menopause and go through menopause, this is very much the time not to stop seeing their providers. It is very much the time to continue.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard recently on the radio, I think it's a documentary about Gilda Radner, the great comedian who unfortunately died of very early ovarian cancer.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I just think of that as being a reminder. And my guess is she was getting good medical care. Who knows? Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we talked a little bit ago about uterine cancer, and I mentioned how the good thing about uterine cancer is that there's signs and symptoms, and that's why a great, great majority of these cancers are diagnosed early and cured. Ovarian cancer, unfortunately, is not like that. You know, we call ovarian cancer the cancer that whispers because there's so few signs and symptoms. However, we actually don't think that's true anymore. We don't necessarily think that ovarian cancer is whispering. We just think that nobody's listening.
Huh. Men.
and women. It goes both ways. But we do actually think that even women with ovarian cancer do have symptoms and do have early symptoms. And so much of this, again, is just education and about awareness.
Okay, well, we're going to want to pick up with that after the break.
Support for Yale Cancer Answers comes from AstraZeneca, a biopharmaceutical business that is pushing the boundaries of science to deliver new cancer medicines. More information at AstraZeneca-US.com. This is a medical minute about melanoma. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. When detected early, however, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. Clinical trials are currently underway to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. The goal of the Specialized Programs of Research Excellence in Skin Cancer, or SPORE grant, is to better understand the biology of skin cancer with a focus on discovering targets that will lead to improved diagnosis and treatment. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Answers. This is Dr. Stephen Gore. I'm joined tonight by my guest, Dr. Elena Ratner, and we are discussing gynecologic oncology and HPV-related cancers. Elena, just before the break, you said something I found very interesting, that ovarian cancer used to be kind of like the silent, thought of as the silent cancer that didn't cause symptoms because of where the ovaries sit and all that. But you're saying that now you're recognizing that there are symptoms oftentimes? So.
Oh, yeah. There have been some studies and some really good studies that show that even at the early stages, women do have symptoms, some bowel symptoms, some bladder symptoms, clothes not fitting very well, not eating great. And in the older days, like 5 years ago, it used
That's
to be
so old.
It used to be chucked up just to menopause. I mean, this was a common thing. You know, women would go see their providers and pretty much be told, you know, this is just normal hormonal changes. And you know, that is probably
usually true,
right? And great majority of women, this is just normal menopausal changes. What separates women who actually have something that needs to be looked at closely from those who just have hormonal changes is that in women with ovarian cancer, these symptoms happen every single day for 2 weeks versus women with hormonal changes, it just comes and goes. But again, you know, so much of, you know, gynecologic cancer landscape is so different now. It's really drastically changing. So much is about awareness and educating women about what's normal, what's not normal, and, you know, also not taking no for an answer. You know, this is always what I say. You know, the current study says that when a woman right now gets diagnosed with ovarian cancer, she has probably had this cancer for 18 to 24 months, and she usually has seen 6 providers before the cancer gets diagnosed. So I usually say, you know, women know their bodies better than anybody. You are your best advocate. You know something is wrong, you go and you get the answer and you don't say no and you don't accept this is normal until you're satisfied.
Well, you know, I'll take my bad marks as a male physician because, you know, over the years, my wife, you know, was worried when she was having maybe some constipation symptoms or something. The first thing she thinks about, you know, is, oh my God, I hope I don't have ovarian cancer. And I'm thinking, okay, come on. I mean, what's the chance? But, you know, the truth is, what you're saying is that, you know, it's not the craziest thing to worry about. And of course, she, knock on wood, gets herself checked out and she's fine, as far as we know, of course. But,
and that's the key.
But I dismissed her.
Right.
Well, I just want to. I apologize, Amy. I didn't mean to be dismissive.
You know, the key is exactly what you just said. You know, ovarian cancer is not common. We got to remember that it is very, you know, 1.4% chance of having ovarian cancer. So, yes, great majority of women do not have ovarian cancer and will not have ovarian cancer. But it's all about awareness. It's all about knowing. And when something doesn't feel right, really just going to your provider. That's all it takes, you know, and having a good exam. And then that's that, you know.
So an exam is sufficient, a vaginal exam by a good GYN.
Yeah. So we don't call them vaginal exams.
Pelvic exams.
Yes, having a good exam by your provider would tell you whether you need anything else. And that something else would be an ultrasound. Sometimes we get ultrasounds. You know, coming back to the beginning of our conversation, the reason why ultrasounds is not enough is that ultrasound by itself actually is not great. But ultrasound together with a good pelvic exam would be a very good assessment and would be sufficient.
Gotcha. Well, then, you know, it's certainly interesting. And what I wonder about is hormones. Like for a long time, you know, many women were put on, you know, estrogen replacement. Of course, some still are for postmenopausal symptoms. And then for a while, that was seen as, you know, potentially contributing to cancer, as I recall. And I think there's always been some concern about oral contraceptives. Where are we at with hormonal therapies, both contraceptives and menopause treatment and the causation of cancer?
Right. So you really brought up a very important and a very kind of divisive question. So birth control pills unquestionably reduce your risk of ovarian cancer. Absolutely. The best protection besides awareness and besides knowing your family history and knowing if you are at higher risk in terms of genetics, but Besides that, the best thing that every woman can do for herself to decrease her risk of ovarian cancer is to take birth control pills. Mm. Any woman who takes birth control pills for 5 years decreases her risk by 50%.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yep. The other way you can get that reduction is to have 5 children and to breastfeed each one of them for 1 year. That's the plan I'm working on. I'm working on that plan, but most other people go with birth control pills. Yes, of course, you got to make sure because, you know, birth control pills, you know, you cannot take if you had a history of blood clots. You know, it's very much an individual. It's not for everybody. It's very much an individual decision. But, you know, this is again, the present and the future is personalized care and really listening to everybody and understanding their history and understanding their risk. Risks, and then understanding how you can mitigate those risks, how those risks can be reduced. Hmm. Birth control pills are unquestionably decrease your risk significantly. Hmm. And these pills, these birth control pills do not have to be taken at the same time. It could be, you know, 2 years here, 2 years there. It's a cumulative benefit. You know? So I always tell all my friends, all my girlfriends, somehow try to get in 5 years of birth control pills during your lifetime so that your risk of ovarian cancer is decreased significantly.
Oh, fascinating.
Hormone replacement therapy is a more difficult discussion. Yes, you're absolutely correct. In the older days, everybody, every woman pretty much who reached menopause would be placed on hormone replacement for her symptoms. And then studies came out, including the nurses' study, that showed that these women had a higher risk of breast cancer. And at that point, everything stopped and pretty much all women were taking off. Some of the providers in the community always tell me stories how the morning after that study was published, they couldn't even get into their office because their phones would just ring because everybody was so afraid and everybody was taking off. But that is also not the case. We, again, are now much better about understanding who needs it, who doesn't need it, what are the risks, what are the benefits. You know, in particular, you know, I do a lot of surgeries for women who have genetic mutations where they go into menopause at young age, let's say 35 or 40. These women unquestionably need hormone replacement. It is not detrimental to them. It's beneficial. It is detrimental for them not to have hormone replacement. And we have many, many studies that show that it's completely safe. Mm. So we know now that estrogen by itself is much safer than we thought. So we no longer say yes or no. This is, again, very much an individualized decision. It matters, you know, how old the woman is, what her risks are, what her benefits are, and what her symptoms are. But certainly even myself as an oncologist, I routinely use hormone replacement therapy in my practice.
Yeah, that's really good to hear or to know about because the scare was pretty big for a long time. Yeah. When you talk about these surgeries for genetic problems, are you talking about prophylactic surgery for women who are at risk of ovarian cancer and breast cancer?
Exactly, exactly. So this kind of adds on the conversation on prevention, where we mentioned previously that the most important aspect of this is to know your risk. So we really need to understand who are the women who are at increased risk of developing these cancers, ovarian cancer and breast cancer in particular. And with these cancers, there's certain genetic mutations that we are always looking for. Some of them are called BRCA mutation. This is the mutation that Angelina Jolie wrote about, and that actually what made it kind of commonplace is her New York Times articles.
And she had bilateral mastectomies prophylactically, right?
And she had her ovaries removed prophylactically.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a challenging information to have, but knowledge is power. Once you know, you are able to prevent cancers and make sure that they don't happen.
Such a tough decision, I imagine.
It is a difficult decision, but it is a much better decision than having to deal with cancer. So much is available right now for prevention, and it's not just hysterectomies or removing ovaries or mastectomies. There's so much more. You know, there's just closer screening. There's more tests. There's closer exams. And of course, this kind of genetic testing is not for everybody. This is really for women who, for whatever reason, are considered to be at high risk, which would mean that they have a number of family members who have had ovarian cancer, breast cancer. But I certainly do not want all the women to worry whether they have this gene or not. This gene is not very common, especially not in the Jewish Ashkenazi population.
It is common among Ashkenazi Jews.
It is more common in the Ashkenazi Jews. And again, in the older days, we used to say, oh, if you're not Ashkenazi Jewish, then you don't ever have to worry.
But that's not true.
But that is totally not the case. There's Italian women, there's Mexican women, there's all kinds of populations that also carry these mutations. But again, this is not for general population. This is not for everybody. This is just for women who have a strong family history of these cancers.
So what is considered a strong family history? One first-degree relative with breast cancer, two... Well, who should be worried? Right. A lot of women have breast cancer. It's common.
Breast cancer is common, and yeah, uterine cancer is common. Uterine cancer is actually not a genetic cancer for most part. The women we worry about are the ones whose family history includes women who got ovarian cancer pretty much at any age or breast cancer before menopause.
I see.
In the older days, again, a few years back, before Myriad had the Supreme Court hearing and they lost the patent for the testing, it used to be really, really expensive. So we needed to have these very strict guidelines as to who can be tested because of insurance being able to approve it. That is no longer the case. You know, Myriad is now just one of the companies who provides this test. So we are now a little bit freer in terms of ordering this test because it is much more affordable and many companies are able to do it. But I usually say, you know, seeing a genetic counselor has a lot of benefit. You don't need to necessarily get tested for genes, but they will help you understand your pedigree, the will help you understand what cancers run in the family and if you are at an increased risk for one cancer or another. So I find genetic counseling an imperative part of this. And if you have any concerns at all about your family history or that you might be at high risk, I would urge you to start with that.
Hmm. And so even among Ashkenazi Jewish women, not everybody should be screened for BRCA.
There's debate and there's some editorials that's been written about that maybe everybody should. And no, the guidelines right now is no, that of course not everybody should. And we really should look at our family history. But yes, it is more prevalent. It's more common in the Jewish Ashkenazi population. So it would not be unreasonable.
Yeah. I have to say my 23andMe, which I did, screened me for BRCA1 and 2. I mean, it was just something that popped out, and obviously it's not a medical test, but it was kind of interesting. And I don't know if they do that for everybody or if they do that because I self-identify or, well, actually, I genetically identify as an Ashkenazi Jew, actually, to tell you the truth. Interestingly, off the topic, but I did find that I have I'm a carrier of an Ashkenazi-associated deafness gene. So, yeah. And we have two friends in Baltimore, Ashkenazi Jews, who have two out of their three children are deaf, and there's no deafness in their family. So presumably, yeah, so you never know. It's kind of interesting.
And we're actually learning so much now from 23andMe or from Ancestry. You'd be amazed how many women I'm actually now managing or seeing who have a BRCA gene diagnosed on one of those
tests. Is that kidding?
Yeah.
You're not kidding.
Yeah, all the time.
You know, that's so interesting. People are doing this for, you know, mostly for kind of interesting social reasons, but... Yeah. You know, and for a long time, they weren't allowed to disclose their medical information. The FDA had prohibited that for a while.
Right. But now women are learning not just about their ethnicity, but exactly as you said, about the genetic mutations that they could have.
Yeah. Well, so what's your feeling about that? Just kind of curious, because they're not getting genetic counseling there. And, you know, you get this thing in the email and it says, oh, by the way.
Well,
people freaking out?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I would freak out.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm, again, a very huge believer that knowledge is power. You know, we are given with the knowledge that we have. And now I just wish that 23andMe or what these companies would actually put in, like, a next line saying, if this is what you have,
you should get screened.
You should see a genetic counselor. And I feel like most people, at least here in Connecticut, are finding their way to appropriate, you know, genetic counselors or GYN oncologists or breast oncologists with this information.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. I hadn't actually expected that, but like I say, it happened to me, you know, in this way. I don't know what I would have done that with that information had I had that when we were having kids, although I suppose I might have had my wife screened.
And this is just the beginning. You know, we are just at the infancy of this information. You know, we know so much more now than we knew 6 months ago, and I think this is only going to be growing bigger and bigger, and I think it's a wonderful thing.
Dr. Elena Ratner is an associate professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at Yale School of Medicine and co-chief in the section of gynecologic oncology. If you have questions, the address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and past editions of the program are available in audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. I'm Bruce Barber, reminding you to tune in each week to learn more about the fight against cancer here on Connecticut Public Radio.